And before that, I was involved for a little while in open source, going back a year or two before then. Actually, a decade or two probably is more accurate. But anyway, moving on, I'm no longer 25. I'm not going to dwell on that. If you want to tweet anything about this, NearED is my Twitter handle. This presentation is about working upstream. Chris said earlier that OPNFE is a project about working with upstream projects and getting change into the upstream projects rather than creating forks and doing things out of tree. But the question arises, why? Why would you do that rather than just satisfy your NFV use cases in OPNFE and not disturb projects for whom maybe that isn't the core focus? Well, first, in terms of NFV and the data center, open source is everywhere. Right? Everything is open source. And the thing is, it's not perfect, especially for NFV. Right? This is a use case which has not been addressed before. This is a quote from a friend of mine. He says open source is 80% as good as the last guy needed it to be. I think that's slightly harsh, but certainly the people who work on the project satisfy their needs with that project, right? And NFV is a new need for projects like OpenStack, right? So there are things that need to be done in these projects. So how does one build on open source projects? How does one change an open source project over time? Well, there are a few ways of doing it. The first and most obvious one is you say, okay, that's almost as good as I need. This particular version of this open source project is almost as good as I need. And I'm going to branch it. I'm going to make my changes on it, make it fit my needs, and I'm good. I've accomplished my goal. Well, the cost of doing that is the work that you do in the branch. But there is an additional cost, which is the opportunity cost of all of the work that's gone into upstream. Right? All of the extra features, all of the security fixes, all of the bug fixes that have gone into upstream that you don't have in your branch. And this eventually becomes a problem when you have situations like, I talked to one vendor yesterday who shall remain nameless, who said, we have 10,000 patches against a 2.6 kernel that we have running in production, and we can't do anything about it because the newer kernels don't satisfy our needs, and we can't port our old patches to this newer kernel. So you end up with a second strategy, which is you say, we're going to branch, and then we're going to rebase. At some point in the future, when we get some time, we'll fulfill our needs on this vendor branch, and then when we get some time, we're going to merge in all of these changes from the upstream branch to make sure that we keep our delta closer. The thing is, you don't do that once, and what happens is your vendor branch continues to diverge, and that cost of doing your actual work, the things, the features that you care about, plus this merge work, which is kind of continual grind and gets bigger and bigger as time goes on, as anyone who's gone through this knows, ends up costing me more over time. It becomes a huge mill wheel weighing you down as you try and make new progress. So you end up with this strategy, which is you say, okay, I'm going to pick this stable release. I'm going to fix it to do what I want. I'm going to re-merge all of the changes from the upstream at some point in the future when I have time. And then when I have time again, I'm going to propose patches back up to upstream to reduce the delta as much as possible from my vendor branch and the upstream branch. And upstream is going to love these patches, right? Because they're fixing things that I needed fixed. I'm going to just send my work up and it's going to be done. Well, there are a few costs involved here. There's the work you've done, there's the cost of the merge, and then there's what I call community overhead. And what does community overhead mean? Well, our communities expect lots of things that you wouldn't normally do. Just one example, when you're picking a version of a project to work on, you're going to pick a stable version. Right? So your vendor branch is up there. But when the community wants patches, they want patches where they're working. They want patches down there. And that's maybe 6 months, maybe 12 months on from where you've been working. So what you have to do is you have to figure out how to take all of the stuff from your vendor branch, report it to the upstream tip of the head, as they say, tip of the trunk, and get that work into upstream. example. There are many examples of this, but this is a pretty big one. Wake locks from the Linux kernel. Right, so 2005, Google acquires Android, the company. 2009, a developer who had formerly been working for Android, Arva Yunivac, proposes wake locks for the mainline kernel. This is something that had been developed by the Android project and maintained out of tree for 5 years. The initial proposal was rejected. It was a big patch. The initial proposal was rejected. There were some comments. And then kind of the discussion died down for a year. There were a few iterations, but it died down. 2010, the debate came back. Wake locks was proposed again. An alternative proposal called AutoSleep from Rafael Wysocki, who I believe was speaking today, was proposed, and the two were debated on the Linux kernel list. And I said debated, quote unquote. This ended up being about a 1,500 email thread. It went on for about 2 months. And at the end of that, the patches from Rafael Wysocki were merged, and the wake locks from the Android team, as far as I'm aware, are still living outside the kernel. Two quotes from two people who were at Google at the time. Ted So said that many of the developers have been burnt out by this. This is the cost, right, of doing things this way. Over 1,500 mail messages, nearly 10 megabytes. It took hundreds and hundreds of man hours to debate this to the point where it got rejected. Anyway, Chris DeBona said that there were several developers who felt burned, and he said, we recognize that this team did not have the staffing, attitude, and culture to make this stuff work. So how can you fix it? Well, there's one way is to ensure that you have somebody who's a name in the project who's actually working with you to get that code upstream. And another way is just do not build up code over many years in a vendor branch. These are all renowned kernel developers giving this advice. This is not coming from people who have not seen this pattern reproduce itself over time. So here's what the ideal situation is. Here's what you should be doing. Here's what upstream does. Here's what developers in the open source world do. If you want to submit a feature to an open source project, you build it on the tip of trunk. You build it by forking off the unstable trunk branch. And then when you want to deploy that to production, you cannot wait for the stable release to come out and be qualified and so on. You backport the features that you're interested to the production branch, which is going to be unstable. So you're developing on the fast-moving piece, and you're taking only what you want back to the slow moving. And it works really well, but it's not cost-free. There are a few difficulties. First, it's hard to sync product and project release dates and features. Either your upstream project is going to be time-based releases, in which case maybe the features that you care about won't get into the next stable release, or it's going to be feature-based releases, in which case maybe the upstream release will not come in time for your planned project release. And obviously, product releases, they're planned several months in advance, and if you have to bump a product release because an upstream project hasn't released yet or is releasing late, I'm not going to name any names here, but there are several projects that are well known for running a month or even years late, then that's a problem, right? Essentially, you're building a castle on quicksand. You're trying to develop stable features that you're going to be using in production on a fast-moving code base. Right? So there is a cost involved here. Finger in the air, and it's going to be about double the work, one and a half, twice the work. And one of the interesting things about this figure is, if you talk to open source developers about this, they say, well, that feels a little low. And if you talk to people who are developing on top of these open source projects and who have not been engaging upstream, they're saying, funny, you're telling me I have to budget twice the time of this developer's time to get this work upstream, and they think it feels high. So there's obviously a difference in expectation. There's a second difficulty which came up in the wake locks example, which is that you can do all this work, you can engage with the upstream projects, you can debate your features, and you can still have your thing rejected. There's a well-known case study of IBM many, many years ago. They developed EVMS, Enterprise Volume Management System, on top of, I don't even remember what version of the Linux kernel it was at the time. They developed their patches against the tip of the trunk. They maintained a branch in BitKeeper at the time for many months. They were communicating very well with the kernel community. They proposed their patches, and 2 weeks after the patches were proposed, an alternative implementation called LVM2 by a small company called Cortina was accepted instead. IBM, Cortina was accepted by the kernel developers, and IBM, the day afterwards, said, okay, we're going to abandon EVMX, the kernel patches, we're going to port all of our user space tools over to LVM2, and they were hugely praised by the kernel community, and rightly so for that decision. But think of all of that extra work that they had to do, plus the work they invested in EVMX in the first place. So there are costs involved. Okay, so why is this relevant to OpenFV? Well, NFV is not just OpenStack. We hear about OpenStack a lot in the OpenFV world, but there are, and this is just one potential stack. There are multiple possible SDN controllers, there are multiple hypervisors, there are multiple even infrastructure as a service layers. Even there are choices in the vSwitch layer. So, to deploy an NFV stack, you're deploying multiple components together, and all of these components are going to need changing. Just a couple of examples. If you want to implement SRIO vSupport, it's a very popular feature request for NFV because it gives you a hardware level network performance in VM by doing PCI pass through from a virtual function on an SRIO device to the virtual machine. Well, you need performance work. You need VMs to be allocated. So you need the ability to allocate the SRIOV virtual function to the VM. That needs changes in your infrastructure service layer, in libvirt, in KVM, in kernel. You need to have NUMA awareness so that you're allocating your SRIOV device on the same NUMA node as the VM. That needs to be propagated through Nova, libvirt, QEMU. PCI pass-through needs to be supported all the way through. You need to be able to advertise that you have an SRIOV device on the host so that the scheduler can put the VMs that need that device on the right host. So there are changes all the way through the stack here. Second example for virtualized mobile base station, CRAN or VRAN. Well, you need determinism, so real-time patches to KVM, performance, so you need to have user space acceleration of data plane processing. You need reliability at scale, so multi-site support needs to improve. HA OpenStack, you need to have improved IPv6 support, fault management reporting. All of these things need to be improved, and they all affect multiple components of the stack. Okay, why am I going down this track? It's because OpenFV is an upstream first project, and what does that mean? Well, if you're trying to change multiple components in a stack at the same time, and you get these kind of cascading features coming from one feature request, you need to modify 5 or 6 projects, you end up doing one of two things. Either you do your patches out of tree, you make the thing work, and then you maintain them over time, or you try and get those things, break them down by project, and try and figure out, okay, how can I get this into the tree cascading from the top down? If you go for the maintaining out of tree patches, it's not sustainable over time. You end up with a maintenance burden which far outweighs the benefit of doing that. So features should be written and proposed with the upstream projects. I think we all agree on this, but it bears restating. And cascading changes requires more than just actually doing the patches, it requires advocating for the upper level use case, the actual high level big picture, rather than focusing on just the feature that you're trying to achieve. Because if you're just proposing a patch and saying, we'd like your project to do this, without explaining the larger context, well, that may just not make sense in the micro, whereas it will make sense in the macro. So you need to have a kind of an advocacy and communication across multiple projects as well. That's kind of the role of OpenFV as I see it. It requires discipline to work upstream, so it needs smaller changes and they need to be discussed first. You need to do your planning upstream. And again, there are many from you. So working upstream, well, it's not always easy. There's some work to be done. So the goal of this presentation is to walk you through some ways that you can think of working upstream. Some tools that you can bring to bear when you're working on. So before I go on, I didn't have a very clear idea of the audience. So can I ask who here is a software developer? Who here has experience working in open source communities? And who here is a software developer who does not have a lot of experience working in open source communities? And who here is working for CSP, NEP, working in telco? One person working in telco in the room. You work for an NEP. Okay. Thank you very much. I just wanted to. So I'm probably going to be preaching to the choir here. Hopefully, you'll find this useful anyway. Some of it goes two ways. Some of it is advice which is good for projects welcoming new contributors. But the goal that I had was to help people who maybe are not familiar with working in open source projects to frame that participation in a way which will allow them to be successful in their participation. So the first most important point is to have empathy, right? To try and put yourself in the place of the other person that you're viewing. So I'm going to do a quick thought exercise. If you can close your eyes, bear with me. Okay. Now, you're using a project that you've used for many years, and you found an issue, something that doesn't work quite the way you want to, in a module that's part of this project. And you spend 4 hours figuring out the object structure and figuring out the APIs of this project, and you've figured out how to fix it to make it do what you want. I want you to think of the thrill of actually having that patch, having that feature ready to go. You've got your Git tree that has this diff, which you think solves this problem. Okay, think of that feeling. Now go to the project website and you try and figure out how to submit that patch. Okay, so first thing, you go to the project's website, and there's a link to their Git repository, but not to the module's Git repository. So it's a minor frustration. You go looking in the website for the module. You find the module's website, which is pointing you to an SVN repository that is 3 years out of date. Okay, so you try and figure out maybe there's a bug tracker. Can you think of a case? So you go to you start looking for maybe Bugzilla or Jira or whatever it is. You start using Google to look for the bug tracker because the bug tracker is not linked on the website. Now I'd like you to feel that frustration that's starting to build up because now you've had 4 hours doing a patch and it felt good. And now it's an hour later and you still haven't figured out how to submit that patch. So you find the bug tracker, you open a bug, you get a comment back telling you that the page is out of date and pointing you to the Git repository. So this is great, this is progress, right? So you go and you rebase your patch on the Git repository, you spend another hour fixing it so that it works on the latest version of the module. Now, another hour goes by because you've got your patch in Git, and now you have to figure out how to submit it to the project. And you figure out that the project is using Garrett. Now, I don't know if any of you are familiar with Garrett. But in many projects, when you're using Garrett, you have to actually contact somebody to ask them to approve your access to Garrett. So you have an account creation, you create your account on the Garrett page, you do that project, and then you say, okay, how do I know who to ask? Are you new to this project? Now think of the intimidation that you have when you try and figure out, okay, do I ask on a mailing list, so I have to go and subscribe to a mailing list, or do I try and find an IRC channel? How do I find out who I should ask about this? So you go to an IRC channel, you find the IRC channel, another half an hour has passed. Your Garrett account is approved. You submit your patch. You're feeling pretty good about yourself. It's 4 hours patch, 4 hours later, you're submitting your patch. Now, 5 minutes later, white space issues. Think of the frustration. What white space issues?
Can you point me to the coding guidelines, please? I didn't find any coding guidelines.
So you go and you ask on IRC, and somebody gives you some advice on how you can fix these white space issues. You send in the second patch request. There are some more comments. A lot of them are to do with the forum. You're feeling pretty good at this point. You're feeling like you're engaged with the community. And then a third comment comes back from somebody you have no idea who it is, who says, you're doing it wrong. Here's the correct way to do it. And you say to yourself, I have no idea how to do that. Well, I don't know this project. Anybody who's used Derek, again, you know that it's hard to pass a patch on to somebody else. So at this point, you give up. You've given up. Right? You did a patch. You spent 4 hours of your time trying to figure out how to do this right. Now it's 8 hours later. You've gone through three round trips with the community, and you're essentially ready to throw in the towel. Right? It works for me. It's on my computer, and I'm going to maintain this patch. Now, I want you to close your eyes again. Or don't. That's okay. But I think the closing the eyes. You're a developer on that project. You receive about 20 different patches coming in every hour. Every single one of them doesn't conform to the basic coding guidelines that you've laid out, and they're in the wiki. If you just know where to look for them, they're there. The basic coding guidelines, the basic indentation guidelines that you've had. So the first thing you do is you run a basic spell check, and you just take the patch, update it, and resubmit it for them if it was easy, but the tools get in the way. Now imagine how frustrating that is. So you give them the comment, white space issues, and it's even a templated comment because you have to do it 20 times an hour. Right? Now, I can understand, right? You'd like to be more helpful, but really, you've got, this is not the only thing you do. You're probably a volunteer on this project, right? You're reviewing patches for half an hour during your lunch break. Now imagine how frustrating it is that all of the patches that arrive, or most of the patches that arrive, don't follow basic guidelines that you give. Then the patch comes back. It's got a magic number in it. It's got a fixed string that should really be a parameter. And you say, okay, I'm going to point out the three biggest issues with this, right? And the contributor disappears. They say, I don't know how to do this, and then it's, okay, well. Now imagine how frustrating that is, right? If you're a regular contributor to a project, there are things that should be easier. You would like there to be a nice way to bring people into your project, but in fact, most people don't read the documentation. Most people don't go looking for coding guidelines. Most people don't try and figure out the right way to do something. They will fix it on their machine, and they don't think of it as a product that's going to be delivered to thousands and hundreds of thousands. So, when I talk about empathy, that's the kind of thing I'm talking about. So I did go looking for some bugs. They're not hard to find, right? This is just one from the from GCC. So, bug was created because an assert int plus 100, so it was an integer plus 100 greater than an integer, so C plus 100 greater than C, was optimized away by the compiler. Right? The goal of that, if you're not a C programmer, is if the integer overflows, a signed integer typically becomes a negative integer, so max int plus 1 becomes min int. But that is completely undefined behavior. It's just the way most compilers work, because that's the way numbers are stored in memory. And some developers rely on it anyway. So this asserts, the compiler says, well, that's always going to be true, bigger number, greater, smaller number, so it optimizes it away. So the second comment says, well, actually, you know, you're relying on undefined behavior here. You really should do that. And it's the very, very indignant commenter said, you have got to be kidding. I've only picked a few of the comments here. This is a very choice book, 30475 on GCC, if you want to go and read the whole thing. He goes in and chops it off. This is not a joke. Fix it now. It's broken. You're breaking people's code. And he's very enthusiastic about it because this is obviously something that he's used a lot and it's changed. It's
its behavior does change between one version of GCC and another, and as far as the GCC developers are concerned, this is fixing a bug. Right? This is a completely valid optimization. Right? In fact, it's a meta bug, because if you use a different -03 instead of -02, the problem goes away, or the other way around. And it goes on and on and on. And 56 comments later, has he accomplished his goal? No. Right. So again, this is about, if he had been putting himself in the place of the C developers here, maybe he might have gotten a better outcome. That's the point. So how do you frame discussions with open source communities? Excuse me, I've got a bit of a cough here on the little horse.
Do I have a...
So one metaphor I like is moving in. Except in an open source project, nobody actually sees you moving in. So it's like moving in the dead of night. And somebody sees you in the morning. Oh yeah, anyway. When you move into a new neighborhood, everybody's moved into it. Has everybody here moved at some point in their life to a new town, new neighborhood? So what do you do when you move to someplace new? Well, first you try and figure out who's who your neighbors are, where the school is, where the post office is, where all of the supermarkets are, all of this kind of stuff. The first thing you start doing, you start exploring. You start looking for information about the place around you. You don't come in and say, well, that's ridiculous, right? That intersection. Well, maybe you do. I mean, every now and again, I just recently moved to the state, and there's just this one intersection where it's like, why is there not a stop sign there? Why is there not? There should be a stop sign. Anyway, and what's with turning right when the lights are red? I don't get that. So anyway, think of some of the things that neighborhoods do to welcome new members as well. The things like coming over with cupcakes. We had our neighbor came over and dropped us off some brownies. Very nice, just to say welcome to the neighborhood. We went and introduced ourselves to the neighbors, just to let them know who we were, where we were coming from, ask some advice on the local lay of the land. And that's the kind of thing which I would definitely recommend you do in joining a new open source project. Another way to look at it is maybe a new job, which is actually probably for this type of community, but maybe even more appropriate. Has anybody here ever worked with somebody who joined and looked at something that's been done a certain way for a certain amount of time that probably you were involved in putting in place, which was a set of compromises of competing forces? If everybody had their own agenda that they wanted to bring to this thing, and they looked at it and they spent 2 weeks bitching about how it was ridiculous and how it was awful and it needed to be fixed. And they take it to the company mailing list and say, why is this so ridiculous? Has anybody ever worked with somebody like that? I've definitely worked with somebody like that. So how do you tell someone, well, actually, that was me, and let me give you all of the background and all of the reasons why this is the way it is, and we recognize that it's not optimal, and it'd be great if it got fixed, but it was just set up this way because of this, and it's evolved over time to become crusty and annoying, and yes, it should be fixed, but, time. Do you take the time to do that, or do you just say, sort of, flip the bozo bait on that guy? I don't know. I'd try and be more kind and guiding, but it's hard. So think of joining a new community as similar to starting a new job. Don't be that guy. Right? Try and ask some questions before you start bitterly complaining about the way things are. Right? Try and figure out why they're the way they are. So start small, listen for a while, ask questions, introduce yourself, and have an open mind. Don't ask questions like, why is this so idiotic? Right? Ask questions like, can you explain to me how this process came to be? Because I don't understand it. That's a better question. And if you're framing your participation in a community in that way, these are a kind of obvious steps, right? Second is similar to moving into a new neighborhood or starting a new job. Relationships are key, right?
you get things done through others when you're joining an open source community, because there are always others who are going to be gatekeepers to what you want to achieve, similar to a job, similar to a neighborhood. So you have to learn the cultural expectations and the cultural norms of the community when you get involved, and build those relationships, make friends over time. So how do you map the lay of the land? Well, the first step is to try and identify the leaders, identify the people who are the momentum, the decision makers, right? So going back to that very personal experience that I had, that I was guiding you through of trying to figure out how to contribute a patch to a project, that commenter on Garrett, who I couldn't find anywhere in the code history, I couldn't find him in the mailing list, he was not the decision maker. He was not the person who decided that my patch was wrong or would not be accepted. But the decision maker was a guy who's not very vocal on the mailing list, who just kind of contributes patches to maintains this in Git. And he read that comment and agreed with it. So I needed to look in the Git history, figure out who was the guy who's maintaining this project, go talk to him on IRC, try and get a hold of him. And then he told me, oh yeah, no, I agreed with that comment. That's fine. That you need to do this and this and this and this. I said, well, I don't know how to do that. And he said, well, I'll try and help you, but I didn't have time because it was 3 weeks later and the moment had gone. But this is the way you identify leaders. So how do you identify leaders? Well, there are a few. I'm going to give a case study from Open Daylight. Many projects now have kind of metrics dashboards. So Open Daylight has the wiki, and wiki, who changes the wiki is actually a pretty good indicator of who you can look for in the leaders. They have a technical steering committee. The technical steering committee members are listed on the wiki. Attending PSC meetings is a really good way of seeing who are the momentum users in a community. And hanging out on the, so this is the various places you can hang out, the various places you can get started. The other way is to actually do look at the stats, right? So Open Daylight has something called Spectrometer, which is Stackalytics, port, I think is how it's described, for Open Daylight, which will show who the contributors are to all of the projects, broken down by release, broken down by date. So this is really the way that you can tell who the technical leaders of the actual technical doers of the community are. Another tool I really like is mailing list stats. In fact, this company called Viturgia has developed a whole suite of these metrics tools that analyze bug trackers and mailing lists and wikis and forums and the whole nine yards. And they have a dashboard called Metrics Grimoire, so that's where this URL is coming from. But mailing list stats will download ML mailman archives from the web and dump them in a database, and then you can query that and find out who the most active domain names are, who the most active posters are, who's doing the most responses on the mailing list. So there are lots and lots of things you can do once you've got all of this data. Okay, second thing in terms of the lay of the land is every project has a set of infrastructure that they provide to their developers. All of these are communication tools. Some of the communication tools are better than others for certain types of communication. The first thing you want to do when you're looking at a website is, where are the mailing lists? Look at the archives, see which ones are dead, which ones are alive. ML stats can help you with that. IRC channel, some projects have an IRC channel which is populated by X is joining, X has left. Some projects just have a very active IRC channel. Wiki, again, recent history can tell you some of that. Some wikis are less organized than others. I'm not going to cite OPNIC or Open Daylight. Actually, both are improving. Code review is a type of conversation. Very, very interesting conversation, actually. And again, it can be very frustrating because code review tools, again, get in the way a lot of the time. I don't know how we can improve that, but it's something that certainly I'm concerned about as a community guy. And source control, commit messages are some kind of communication tool. They're a communication from the past to the future, right? It's why was this done? So please, if you're working on an open source project, put meaningful commit messages because fix some bugs or white space issues is not useful if there's an actual issue that was introduced. But anyway, I'm off on a slide. The key rule, the golden rule, if you will, is when in Rome, do as the Romans do. When you're working with an open source project, follow whatever coding guidelines are used there. If you prefer a four-space indent, but the project uses a two-space indent, well, suck it up. You know, if you prefer using tabs and the project expands tabs to spaces, suck it up. Do whatever the project expects, because that's ultimately what's going to get your patch accepted. Right? So have a look around and try and follow the community guidelines. If patches are accepted on a mailing list, as they are in BPDK, and they're managed by a project called Patchwork, I think. Isn't that anybody here from BPDK? Then you submit your patches to the mailing list, and they're going to be reviewed there, just like the Linux kernel. If your patches go to Garret, then they go to Garret. If your patches go to, I don't know, what other options are there? That's pretty much the only two that are in wide use, I guess. Okay, so that's how you figure out where you're going. Now, how do you make things happen? Well, there are a few tempting options. Once you've identified the leaders, and that's Charles Darwin. Once you've identified the leaders, and you have identified the community norms and community processes, there's a very tempting option, which is to just send a personal email, like to the person you know is going to have the decision-making policy, right? But it's very, very, very dangerous to get into the water cooler mentality, to have an idea of a small group that's invisible to the rest of the community where important issues are discussed and decided. Community projects will reject that unilaterally when it eventually comes out. Right? Either do not let your communities discover patches when they're actually committed to Git and they do a Git pull. Right? That's our new features. Right? That's not the way it's supposed to work. Don't have a series of these fait accompli discussions where you've discussed a blueprint, you've exchanged drafts of it over the course of a few weeks, and then the blueprint gets proposed and approved within an hour. Right? That kind of thing happens, and it's poison. Right? So avoid the water cooler. Try and figure out how to engage earlier. Now, it's completely okay to have these productive side discussions, but make sure that the trace of the results of those discussions and the actual discussions themselves is going to the public forum. So it's important to be open and transparent in your operation with open source projects. That's key. And one of the things which would prevent people from being open and transparent is that you don't want to look foolish, you don't want to make a mistake that you're going to have to commit to over time. Do not fear mistakes. Everything, it can be corrected as long as you are open and transparent and working in this collaborative manner where criticism is not a veto, criticism is a start of discussion. I think that's next door. So communicating the vision is important. I mentioned that earlier, especially when we're working over multiple projects. The idea of NFV is new to a lot of these projects. Explaining to a Nova developer why a certain feature is required because you want to deploy an IMS, and that has a certain constraint that it's putting on the system, well, you have to explain, you know, what the constraint is, why that constraint exists, and where all of the implications that are throughout the stack for the Nova developer to accept that it's important for that use case and potentially for others to fix your issue, right? You're essentially a stranger in a foreign land, and it's important that you're always communicating the big picture when you want to achieve things across multiple projects. And you've got to break things down. You've got to break things down into components. We've talked about cascading patches. You've got to make sure that you understand that if this patch is a prerequisite for this other patch in a different project, that is communicated all the way through the chain and why. And code should be optimized not for writing, for reading. Code review of tens of thousands of lines of code is never going to happen. If you submit a 10,000 line patch to any open source project, it will lay ignored for months and months and months. And you should not expect anything else. It doesn't matter how cool the feature is that it's implementing. Nobody is going to sit through 10,000 lines of patches. You've got to break it down so that a patch has to tell a story. It has to tell one piece of a story really well. So that's the whole point of breaking things down. And again, a patch set with 50 patches, where patch 43 depends on patch 21, that's not much better. Right? Break things down into easily consumable parts that fit into a big picture, like a jigsaw puzzle. But don't make the person make the whole jigsaw puzzle to understand why that piece is important. Key piece of doing that is if anybody here is familiar with Git rebase, Git rebase minus minus interactive, or Git rebase minus I is magic. It allows you to something which is for the traditionalists among us in source control, heresy. It allows you to rewrite history. It allows you to pretend that things happen in a different order to the way they happened. So let's say you have a patch that looks a little bit like that. You've got a first draft, rewritten to a second draft, rewritten to a third draft, some bug fixes, maybe you start working on a second feature, and then you add some more bug fixes, and then you've got a fourth draft, and then you end up with something like this. But it allows you to take those 50 patches, reorder them, squash them together so that you can put the bug fixes with the patch that was that had the bugs in them, and submit that as three lovely, clean, pristine patches. So that's what Git rebase minus I does. Learn it, it's useful. Everybody here probably knows it already. Be aware that the patch review process is not always easy. People will be critical of your work. It's not in the goal of beating you down. It's in the goal of improving the project. So you do have to be persistent on this. It's, like I said, it's about twice as much work as doing the patch in the first place. And that's probably a conservative estimate. Right? I said 1.5 to 2 times. I was trying to be nice. Most projects is probably going to take more work than that to get the patch upstream.
Isn't that just kind of the first few times you do it, as you go through it, does it get easier, you know, as you learn?
Definitely. Definitely. That's why one of the key suggestions is work with somebody who's already in the project, because they can guide you through the process and make sure that you're not going through 7 iterations, you're only going through 3 iterations. But some projects are resistant to certain types of change. For cultural reasons, that's going to be much harder. Just to give you one example, in the OpenStack project, OpenStack is infrastructure as a service. One of the bylines of the project is tabular pet, and a lot of the NFV type features are actually rather pet-like.
HA
instances, SQL pass-through.
VM migration.
Like migration is another one, yeah. So a lot of these features are rather pet-like, and a lot of OpenStack Nova developers are resistant to those changes culturally because it feels like it's making OpenStack into a vSphere.
Yeah.
So you've got to be aware of that, and got to work with that over time as well. And again, it's keeping your eyes on the price. What do we want to achieve in OpenNFV? We want to make a collection of open source projects that work together to provide a good platform for NFV. That's the end goal. The end goal is not to have SRIOV pass-through supported. It's not to get real-time patches into KVM. It's to be able to run a CRAN or to run IMS or to run EPC. So communicating that big picture vision all the time across multiple projects is, I think, key to success. Oh, and since we're in OpenStack Summit pimping time, I'm going to pimp my presentation proposal for OpenStack, which is OpenNFV related, on making OpenDaylight and OpenStack work together. You can vote for me there. Thank you very much. I am happy to take some questions while I still have some questions. So the question was for the people who couldn't hear on the phone. The question was, would I like to say something about continuous integration? I am not sure I have anything useful to say about that. I mean, in the context of getting change upstream, I think one of the things that OpenNFV can do very usefully, and I know Chris touched on this, but is to be able to advertise that big picture by having deployments where you can test VNFs and say, look, here's what we're seeing with these VNFs running on this test platform, and here's where the issues are that we're seeing, and here's why we need these fixes.
Normally, when we do development, we know we are in the upstream and we directly put everything in. But here, the continuous integration is just pulling stuff, not being able to respond by saying these are the changes I need. And that's what initially we thought, but now we see the requirement directly go to the upstream and then it comes from upstream.
Well, I see where you're going, and I actually agree, but I also think that this is one of the core ways that the OpenNFV project can contribute to those upstream projects, is to actually provide these real-life style deployments that can be used as a testing and performance platform for these upstream projects. And I know that the OpenStack project, for example, has specifically asked for OpenNFV to provide more NFV testing frameworks and continuous integration, continuous deployment, so that they can see some of the issues that we're seeing. So I think this is a very valuable service that we're providing. I think it's a key way that we have can create a communication bridge with the upstream developers.
In terms of OpenStack, that product development is required. There's a process and there's operation. So they call it as requirements, process, and operation. Now we have requirements. We have our own requirements. They have their own requirements. Now, should we direct requirements for it? Should we, once you say collaboration and development, then you are saying that the collaboration happens in the upstream. So the requirement happens here, collaboration happens in the upstream.
Well, it's a question of scope, right? The OpenNFV project, the requirements are VNF driven, I would say. The requirements in OpenStack are going to fall out of that. So in terms of creating blueprints in the OpenStack project and getting patches that implement those blueprints in the OpenStack project or in OpenDaylight or wherever, there's going to be a big picture requirements at the CSP and NEP level, and then there's going to be the individual project level features, right? And we already have an example. I mentioned SRIOV. IPv6 is another one where there are these cascading requirements. So there are multiple IPv6 related blueprints in OpenStack, for example. There are multiple SRIOV and NUMA related blueprints in everything from, like I said, from Nova right down to KVM, right, QEMU. So it's a question of scope. I think OpenFV is focusing on the higher level. We're talking to CSPs, we're talking to NGPs, they're participating in the project, on helping us define the high-level requirements, and then breaking those high-level requirements down into the smaller pieces that I was talking about earlier that fit into the bigger picture for the underlying project.
Do you see the research and engagement into involvement upstream as being formed by do you see the investment into the project and the research and communication as being formed by every contributor in the organization who was on the project? Or do you see more, is it, in your experience, is it very obvious on that that engages as a single point of contact and helps funnel and centralize the information?
I would say liaison is not good. I would say in general that involvement by proxy does not work. It doesn't scale. What does work is guide. Right? So if you have one person who is deeply familiar with the community, who helps bring people through that process inside their organization as colleagues, I think that's a very, very valuable thing to do. And a lot of open source projects do try to have a guide. As Phil knows, we've been trying to put that in place for the Open Daylight project as well, in terms of when we see new companies or new contributors arriving, just to make sure they have a good initial experience. I think that's very valuable. So I would frame it as guide rather than liaison or proxy.
A guide in the upstream project or a guide in the organization?
So it would be somebody using both, yeah. Okay. Yes, Steven.
I'm new here, and I understand there's a lot of people that are used to, if I understand things correctly, there's a lot of people that are used to doing things in the telco space from a standards perspective. And a liaison between standards organizations, between working groups, is a very natural thing to do in that world. And I would encourage them to stay pointed out that it's not a good idea to do that in an open source community. If you're really simple with liaisons in the standards world, that would lead to explore projects down and consulting. You're adding lines of communication and simple close offsets on things like that. Whereas in a open source community based organization, you really want to be contributing upstream. You want to be working there, even if it's, they have some excellent examples here of the patient and how to think about that participation. First off, this morning I had a number of people expressing concerns over, how do I get people in the witness? Well, it's the witness. And that's how you make things happen.
Okay. I think I'm out of time. Thank you very much.